Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome back Tainar Simpson. Good to see you again.
Thank you. You too.
Let's start with the recent election of the band council. By the way, congratulations on your re-election for a second term. How close a race was it?
Well, it was definitely a tight race. I was running against a former two-time chief. He was very well liked, and of course, I really like him as well too. So it was a close race, but at the same time, it was a very polite race, and there wasn't any mudslinging, you know, that you might see in other elections around the block. But yeah, so it was. I appreciated the tone of the election. And I got in by 44 votes.
What do you attribute to your victory?
Well, I think staying on message and just trying to tell and show the community everything I've been doing for the past 2 years and hoping that they wanted to see those projects and initiatives continue. I also reached out to the off-reserve population, which is actually 2/3 of our membership numbers. So I don't want to ignore them, because a lot of times you're focused mainly on what's happening in Alderville and the community and how you can help members there. But as someone who lived off reserve almost my whole life, I understand that the off reserve members have a distinct set of needs.
Who was elected to band council?
Well, we have two returning councillors, Councillor Lisa McDonald, Councillor Jason Marsden, and we have three new members to council, and that's Amber Crow, Joanne Smoke, and Cassie McEwen.
What issues came out of the election campaign that are significant for you and the band council going forward?
Well, I think environmental protections, environmental stewardship was something that kept coming up more and more, generally more than normal. So I think these environmental issues are going to take a precedence. We're seeing, with climate change, we're seeing changes in the weather. And right now we're going through a drought. So we know that things are different than they used to be. So we're taking those steps to correct them and, live with them, really.
And just very quickly, remind everyone the changes that have taken place following this election and their significance.
Okay, well, under our new custom election code, the big difference is that we have three-year terms. So up until now, we have been under the Indian Act election regulations, which were for two-year terms. But so now we have three, as well as five councillors. So we went from four to five.
In July, you were part of a group of Indigenous leaders who are launching a lawsuit against Bill 5 and C5. Those are recently passed bills aimed at economic growth in Ontario and across the country. You and I have spoken about your concerns. Why was the lawsuit necessary in your mind?
Well, the legal challenge came about because we didn't really see any other avenue to removing these bills from becoming legislation. So our concerns with Bill 5, the provincial bill, is more so than the Bill C5, whereas we feel Bill C5 can be changed to meet our needs. Again, with the removal of Section 6 and 22, we feel that Bill 5, the provincial legislation, is completely wrong, wrong-headed, and we just want to see that fully taken off of the books where it comes to environmental protection, species at risk, and as well as Indigenous consultation, and of course the special economic zones.
That's a pretty tall order to ask that a piece of legislation that was just recently passed be repealed. What do you say to justify that?
Well, with Bill 5, we see a number of illegal acts. This law allows you to break the laws. So when that happens, then we feel that it's an unjust law. It also goes against the Constitution in Section 35 rights. So we feel that the bill itself is unconstitutional. And again, that can't trump our relationship with the Crown. So we feel that there's just too many things wrong with the bill, and it's not, you can't really save it. We can't allow these species to go extinct without even knowing that they're there. We can't have the ground dug up and not know what's under there, not know what type of environmental damage you're doing, or if there's something of archaeological significance there.
Fair enough, but I mean, there is the opportunity. I mean, you've only met once with the premier, and I don't know of any other meetings that were held between the premier and yourselves. Why was a lawsuit necessary?
Well, really, because there's no will in the provincial government to take the law off the books. They're not really looking at changing any of it. So we feel that we had to force the hand to see this through. So we have a law firm, Woodward, who we've been working on with on some other issues. So they went to their current and existing clients to get the number to have this lawsuit put forward, this challenge, and it's open to other First Nations to join on, and we're expecting that to happen.
Last month, you were part of a press conference that announced this lawsuit. And when you were given the opportunity to speak, you said you were given a mandate to stop this bill at any cost. When did that mandate come about, and who gave it to you?
This is a mandate directly from our citizens. I heard it over and over again. People were saying we have to stop this. And we were hearing that they wanted to go to any lengths to make sure that this stops. Nothing has triggered a strong response from us just yet, because we still aren't sure exactly how the province is going to move forward implementing the bill. But we know that our citizens are ready to take action if something happens that we disagree with. So I think the mandate comes directly from the citizens. This was something I heard over and over again. And there really isn't that many First Nations in the province that are for this bill.
You and I have already spoken about your meeting with Ontario Premier Doug Ford. However, I understand you were part of a group of Indigenous leaders who met with Prime Minister Mark Carney last month. Tell us what happened at this meeting.
So this was a historic summit with the Prime Minister. Normally, when First Nations meet with the Prime Minister, it's for to hear them speak for 20 minutes, and then they're shuffled out the back door and you don't see them. This was an unprecedented meeting at the Museum of History in Gatineau, Quebec, with the Prime Minister for the entire day. So he was there from morning to late afternoon. And, we were able to ask a number of questions. We were able to hear his rationale and reasoning for Bill C-5. But Bill C-5 wasn't the only thing on the agenda. There were quite a number of other topics that we discussed. And every chief in Canada was invited to this summit. So we saw a lot of people from all across the country, including former national chiefs, as well as the current national chief.
Well, the reporting out of the meeting was focused a lot on Bill C-5. What other topics got raised that were discussed?
A lot of it was territorial rights issues. So there's a number of things that have been concerning First Nations for quite some time. So we wanted to make sure that issues with historic treaties and modern treaties were discussed. So I think there was important almost like lessons for the Prime Minister, because this isn't his area of expertise. He's in finance, and we don't feel that he has that background information. So a lot of the meeting was to give him that background information. And one of the chiefs actually presented him with an original treaty medal. So these medals were given out during the treaty signing times and a number of years ago. So one was actually presented to the Prime Minister, which he accepted. And so that was nice to see.
And explain why that's significant?
Treaty metal shows that there's an understanding and an agreement between two nations, in this case, First Nations and the government of Canada. So by accepting the metal, he's accepting the treaty relationship and everything that entails.
After the meeting, and even during the meeting, there were mixed reactions from First Nations leaders coming out. What is your response to what got said that day?
Well, overall, the Prime Minister was well-spoken. You could tell that he did some homework on things that were going to be coming up. But at the same time, he didn't really answer the hard questions that were being posed to him. So when we were point-blank asking him if he was going to remove Section 6 and 22, he just wouldn't answer them at all. So any question that he felt uncomfortable with, he kind of just didn't answer, because when people ask questions, they would ask about three or four questions, and then he would respond to those three or four questions. So he would only answer, I guess, the ones he felt were safe and he knew what he was talking about, and other ones he just wouldn't even respond to.
So then what is the different, or what is the same, between your concerns you have with these pieces of legislation now that you've had the meetings and you've come away from them and had some time to think about it?
Well, I look forward to future communications with both the Prime Minister and the Premier. So I think we got guarantees that the Prime Minister was going to meet with us again to work out more specific issues. I think now that he's heard from us, he's probably going back to the table and thinking, how can we get the support? So I really felt like we could work with him. He was saying the right things. Now with the province and Premier Ford, I feel that it's a different set of parameters, and one that isn't going to be as easily solved. But I'd be looking to get back to the table with the Premier, and if we can get those guarantees in place, I would love to hear from him.
I saw a picture of you and the Prime Minister together. Did you get a chance to speak to him directly?
Yes, I did. So it was first thing in the morning when he came in. Normally when a prime minister enters the room, there's a lot of hoopla and picture taking, but he was almost like a ninja. He came in, all of a sudden he was right there. So he had sat down, and I figured that was my best chance to go up and talk to him. So I did. I introduced myself, and we had a brief discussion on some issues, and I just told him thank you for meeting with us, because it was such a historic thing for him to do so.
What's your measure of the man now that you've spoken to him and met him?
He feels and sounds like he's genuine. When he's talking, you can tell he believes what he's saying. I'm not sure if that's because he's a new prime minister and he doesn't understand all the pitfalls and the meaning behind a lot of the words he says, but you can tell he's committed to getting this right and doing the right thing. So I think that allayed a lot of fears of the chiefs, just knowing that we have a prime minister who seems like he's wants to be knowledgeable, understand the issues, and do what's best. Now, if he's going to meet all of our asks and demands, then I don't know. That's still yet to see.
I'm sure some people would be wondering if the ability of governments and industry to negotiate with First Nations, when there are so many voices and so many leaders who have such diverse responses to all the proposals and all the issues, how is it ever going to be possible to move forward with anything when there's such a range of responses to legislation or projects?
Well, I think the first thing that needs to happen is the engagements have to start in an understanding of UNDRIP, treaty rights, and basically what the structure of the nation is. And that is that the First Nations are the rights holders. We didn't cede the land, the territory, as was interpreted by the Crown. So we need to be at those tables at a level that shows that we are the stewards, we are this the rights holders, and it still is our territory. So we would be there as a board of directors or something. We're not a stakeholder. We're not a group that just comes in and puts in our input and it can be taken or ignored. We need to be right there at the top, as it was meant to be under the treaties that we signed.
But let's be honest, there's so many First Nations, there's Métis, there is the Inuit people. You talk a lot about others, but what about First Nations responsibilities? What does your side have to do to help streamline the ability to consult and then move projects forward in a timely way?
Well, working together amongst ourselves is the critical piece for that. We work well with the four Mississaugi First Nations of the Williams Treaty First Nations. We work well with the Williams Treaty First Nations within our own Anishinaabeg Nation Tribal Council. We work well. So it's a matter of everyone getting on board with the same message, the same set of goals. And that's difficult because of the geography. Everyone's got their different issues. But if we can somehow align our strategies and speak with that unified voice, then that's really how we're going to make the biggest changes and move forward in a good way.
That all sounds really, really good. But how do you do that in a concrete way? Do you have any suggestions or examples you could use that would turn that into something concrete?
Yes, so that's the key, isn't it? Really, the more you meet with the other chiefs and share your vision of how you see things happening, I think that more of that needs to happen. Without that communication, then you're going to see nations that might be working in opposite ends. So I think that level of communication is important. Having that leadership one-on-one with each other is key. So that's something that we need to work on a little bit more. And as well, the community members, the citizens of these First Nations really need to have their voices heard and reflected in those chiefs' discussions.
Any idea of the cost of these lawsuits that you're undertaking?
The cost in terms of what we're paying, yes, it's rather expensive. All lawyers are expensive, and especially something like this is even more. So we have it split among 9 First Nations right now, and we feel that it is a cost, but at the same time, it's something that we can't afford not to do. We're talking about the annihilation of our treaty rights on our territory, so we really do need to pay for that, and it's. It's one of those things where, yes, it's expensive, but we have to do it.
What's the dollar figure?
Oh, I don't know if I should get into that, but it's high, but it's not as high as you might think.
How much is Alderville going to contribute?
1/9 of it so far. So it's less than like a car. If you were to buy a car, I'll say that. So that was what we needed to get to where we are now. And depending on how long the case goes through the courts, there would be additional expenses.
How does any of this impact Alderville, since so much of what's being talked about is taking place elsewhere? How does this benefit the community?
Directly benefits, I guess if anything, it's that exposure. It lets other proponents know that Alderville isn't a nation that is going to take these things lightly. So when you have these proponents who are trying to, I'm going to say, get away with not doing their proper due diligence in terms of archaeology and environmental assessment, species at risk, these are things that they will probably change their mind on how to engage with us and fall in line with what we are asking for them to do.
Did you consult with Alderville members? I know you said some people talked to you, but how widely did you speak to the members of Alderville, and was there a vote by the band council to approve this lawsuit?
Well, we actually met with the lawyers. Council met with the lawyers, and it was decided that we can't afford not to do this. So we were all in agreement that this is the right path forward. And as elected leaders, we are elected to lead and make these decisions. So since we had heard only that the community wanted to fight this, we were told to fight it hard. This was our response to that demand.
I'd like to shift gears now for just a moment and talk to you briefly about something going on with the Chiefs of Ontario, which I know you're a member. And this involves the Manitoba Métis Federation as well. Both organizations have come out strongly recently against a nearly $1 billion expenditure in federal funding to the Métis Nation of Ontario. You and I have talked about this before, but I guess I'm looking for a bit of an update because this was in the news recently. It said that these monies were being diverted away from First Nations. Can you refresh our memory and explain what's going on here?
Yes. So I guess if you go all the way back, Métis were recognized in the Constitution, again, with Section 35, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit were recognized as the Indigenous people of Canada. So when that happened, Métis groups across the country popped up. But when you really look at what Métis was at the time, we were talking about the descendants of the Red River Métis group, the original Machif. So this is what we feel was intended by the Constitution. So now anyone can get a Métis card. Whoever is listening to this, if you're not a First Nation member, you can go and get a card from one of these Métis groups. And they were getting funding from the federal government, as you say, close to $1 billion over the last several years, that was intended for Indigenous groups, legitimate Indigenous groups. And what they are trying to do is say that there are six historic settlements, Métis settlements in Ontario, which we know isn't true. We've done the research, we've looked at it, and these claims have no basis in reality. Where there really were like Métis people, they weren't in an organized community or in the way that the Métis Nation of Ontario was saying that they were. Now, there are legitimate Métis people in MNO, but it's just until they get their membership roles in order, they can't be seen as a legitimate organization.
Will you seek legal restitution for this, or another possible lawsuit?
Now with this one, I think really it's already done. We're talking like this was expropriated funds over a number of years. Our concern is that it stops, that these funds for certain programs are going to where they were intended to go, and that's legitimate Indigenous people. But I don't think this is something that we would pick up. It's obviously the large organizations like the Chiefs of Ontario, Anishinaabeg Nation, and probably even the Assembly First Nation would be the ones to take the lead on this one.
There have been two very public events recently since we last spoke. There was the powwow and there was the regatta. How did they go?
They were incredible. I guess we'll start with the powwow, which happened in the second weekend in July. So it was very hot, but I don't remember seeing more people come out to the grand entry as we had on that day, on the Saturday. It was a beautiful day in terms of sun. And the second day got it was also very hot, but we had rain. So when we were about to do grand entry, the skies opened up and it was raining for a good solid 20 minutes. And we took that as a positive sign because it's been such a dry summer. And what happened was the drummers, they started drumming, and people just started dancing, and they went on the arena and they were just dancing in the rain. And so they were rain dancers. It was quite an incredible sight to see. I was very happy to see that.
How about the regatta?
Now, the regatta was really good because this is something that we just brought back last year. So this is only the second regatta since we've started back up. And it got off to a little bit of a late start because some people were coming in slow, and we wanted to make sure we had enough competitors for all of the events to make them worthwhile. So we waited till there was enough people to fill the boats, the canoes. And there was so many people that joined in on the competitions. And myself, I went in on the war canoe. So I was actually got third place.
These are very public events for Alderville, as the general public can be involved. How does this benefit your community?
Well, what it does is it brings awareness to our community and the larger community about the cultural history of our people here in Alderville. So it's one of those events that really defined who Alderville was over the years. The regatta goes back to, I think, 1850 and even before. So this is was something where we would compete with the other local communities here in Northumberland County. And so we got quite a name for ourselves as good rowers, good paddlers. And it was just something really fun to do. So we'd like to keep that going.
But from the community standpoint itself, how do you think members benefit by being involved in this and putting in all the time and the energy and the effort that goes to organizing such huge events?
Yeah, so I was quite impressed with all of our staff and our volunteers who made it happen. The powwow isn't just a two-day event that's here and gone. A lot of the dancers will work all year on their regalia. They'll go to regalia making workshops. They'll source their material. They'll source all of the accessories for their regalia. So it's something that people take very seriously. And also the dancers, they'll be learning their dances. They'll be listening to the music. They'll be going to the other powwows to hone their skills, their dancing skills, as well as the drummers. We have a drum group here in Alderville. We actually have a couple, but we have a Alderville Host Drum, and we also have a few other drum groups. So this is really good to for our men and women to heal if there's something that might be bothering them. A lot of them will join the drum group, and they'll find that spiritual awakening and just really have a good time with it, and it's good for their overall well-being.
How do these events help with reconciliation?
Well, especially with the powwow, you are going to see, I'd say at least half of the people that are there in attendance aren't First Nation. They're from the surrounding communities. They're from the county, and they just really enjoy Indigenous culture. They like hearing the music. They like learning about the history. So by going to the different booths, some of them are informational. They can learn about some of the issues that they might be interested in. So it's something that it really is interactive with the entire community, and it's something that we try to push when we have that powwow. So it's about creating those bonds with the other local communities and people who come from far and wide to see the powwow events.
Do you have any public service announcements for us this week?
Yes, I do. So coming up on August 22nd, all members who have children in junior kindergarten to high school can get a backpack with supplies for them. So this is our back to school backpack program. So again, that's August 22nd. Contact the Alderville Health and Social Services. Thing that we have going on is garden cooking classes, and these are on August 18th and 25th. So if you want to learn how to turn your delicious garden vegetables into meals, please contact Alderville Health and Social Services for that. And on September 6th and 7th, we are having our ATV rider course. So you want to contact MJ Boyle if you're interested in ATV safety and how to properly operate an ATV. And we also have a tick submission program. So if you or one of your pets has got a tick, you can remove it and drop it off at the Alderville Health and Social Services, and then it will be tested to see if it's got Lyme disease or anything else that might be transmissible. And finally, I'd like to announce one of our band members, Kale Crow, has a play at the Capitol Theater. So from August 22nd to September 7th, Res Gas is going to be playing, and it's a collaboration between Kale Crow and another fellow, and it looks like it's going to be a really good play. So we're going to be there for the opening night, and we're looking forward to a good time there.
Chief Tanner Simpson, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, it was a pleasure.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tanner Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tanner Simpson.